You notice this is me up there in the, with a hat on. This is from product of my lab and a bunch of other people. I mean, there's John Harris, myself, James Monroe, David Hawks, and Aisha Furkan is here. And I want to mention there's many, many others that have contributed to this over the year. We have a growing analysis, and this is part of the Tree of Life project. And the whole issue of the unfolding of relationships is really just, I want to sort of get across some things that we've been finding with secondary structure and how that might, you know, impact the way some of you are looking at your own data sets. And again, I want to make it clear that chalcedonids are not Lepidoptera. We do kill all of your Lepidoptera. We don't touch the adults, but, you know, eggs, larvae, you don't get adults because of us. This is a wasp. You know, this is what most people think of a wasp. This is also a wasp, which most people don't really understand how small wasps can get. And that's, of course, not the smallest wasp by the ear there. These, of course, the megalith, you know, eucaridid wasps that love to kill ants and things like that. But generally, we're dealing with very small things. Chalcedonids have a tremendous morphological diversity, but one of the things you have to understand is they're also all very extremely small. We're generally averaging in size about 2 millimeters, but we're going down to it from a tenth of a millimeter all the way up to a gigantic 45 millimeters, but that's a real rare case. But we have a tremendous amount of form and diversity of things, and they also do a million things, too. So basically, you can say that chalcedonids are attacking everything in some different way. We have a few plant-feeding groups, but generally they're attacking virtually every life stage of any group of organisms. Okay, the rundown is basically we're dealing with a group that has 19 families, more than 80 subfamilies, and I think some of the biggest taxonomic changes we're going to come up with out of the Tree of Life is going to be basically making this the Brachys or the Diptera of the Hymenoptera world, where we can take acalypterates and just like blow them up all over the place with a bunch of new families, because that's what it's leading towards. We've got more than 2,000 genera and 22,000 described species. However, as John LaSalle has said before, less than 5% of these can be named because of the lousy descriptions at the turn of the century and earlier. And estimates recently, mostly from John Noyes, but also an independent study by myself, suggest as many as 500,000 morphologically distinct species may potentially exist, and that has absolutely no bearing on what we're finding in terms of cryptic species complexes. So there could be a tremendous explosion in what we actually start recognizing as true species here. We have a number of potential sister groups that we can look at. We've got cynopoids, diapreids, platygastroids, seraphronids, and myromatids. These have all been proposed at some point in the past, so we've thrown these all into our outgroups within our particular analysis in some degree of form. We have a large, again, all the families of chalcedoidea represented here with, you know, sort of give you the rogues gallery of what these things can look like. And again, as Lepidopterists, we've probably all reared these things out at some point in time and cursed them in some way. We also have some, you know, things are not stable. After all this time, we still haven't been worked out. There's a few groups that we cannot actually place anywhere. So if you saw my grad student's poster on the Kayla signs over there, you'll find out that, you know, we still have absolutely no family that we can place this particular subfamily. We have the bizarre acapel lines from Australia. I have another grad student working on the zootines, and he's still trying to figure out exactly whether they're closer to trichogrammatids or to cygnophorids. Eretmosaurus is one genus that has a subfamily placement, but at the moment it probably doesn't belong there, and a bunch of other things that go on and on. Eric Russell, in his psychedelic days of the 80s, managed to come up with a bubble phylogeny of relationships, and actually, if you look at it carefully, it actually holds up pretty well for what we're considering right now in terms of our relationships. John Noyes put this in a moment of haste in a chalcedoid newsletter. He came up with an intuitive phylogeny. There's no data on this, but this was just his feelings of relationships. The characters that are mapped on there are some work that I did later on. But I really just want to point out that, you know, there is some indications of the relationships here. We're dealing with, you know, mimerids down here at the base. These are largely egg parasites of a lot of heteropterans. We have these couple of rotoidas and tetracampids, which you may not know anything about. But we do have this sort of soft-bodied eulophid lineage over here with trichogrammatids, eulophids, and aphelinids over here. And then we have basically the large, hard-bodied things with the exception of some Encertids, Tania stigmatids, and eupelmids over here. So we basically have the hard guys, the soft guys, and the little itty bitty guys. The consensus opinion of chalcedoid workers is really pretty much stable. We have no idea beyond my marriage, and I'm sure John Wenzel's, subtree consensus might help to resolve that a little bit, but not much. The problems, of course, we're facing are largely three, and I'm not going to have time to present examples. We've got homoplasy through reduction, convergence, and essentially what I think is a large explosion of diversity at the early to late Cretaceous. So at the early Cretaceous, you cannot recognize anything as being a chalcedoid. By the mid-Cretaceous and Amber deposits, you're actually starting to see the chalcedoid groups, and by the late Cretaceous, everything's formed. So it's a real rapid period of evolution, again, because it's killing your things. Back in 2000, we came up with a preliminary phylogeny. This is basically about 99 taxa within this particular tree. We did have some conclusions. We have a basal mimeras, we have calosines basal to the remainder. We have some groups which are monophyletic in the analysis, and basically we thought they'd be monophyletic anyway. We have a number of groups that were not monophyletic, and we didn't know what to deal with some of these things like aphelinids, chalcidids, and, well, you know, this one always caused me no end of grief for the last several years. And then we have some which were represented by a single taxon, and we have absolutely nothing to say about those ones. So preliminary results and you know, not a lot of support for a bunch of things. So where are we going on to now? We're looking at a calcedoid twig of the Hymetal project. We're responsible for both a morphological and molecular approach. We're trying to straighten out the molecular first before we start throwing in our morphology and sort of directing the data set along that way. I just want to mention we're coding up at the order and subfamily level across Hymenoptera. We're looking at order level genes, which range from complete 18S to 28S to CO1 and EF1 alpha. We tried some forkhead, but it found out it was part of a gene family and had to basically throw out that data. We coded diverse representation of all calcedoidea. And the last part is, looking specifically at the calcedoidea, which I'm going to talk about first, we're looking at basically the middle chunk of 18S, which is the most variable region there, and then 28S D2 to D5. And again, one of the things is we're looking at a lot of taxa. These are the easiest genes for us to extract on a consistent basis. Joe Gillespie helped a number of students in my lab and some others develop a secondary model which was specific for calcedoidea. We based this almost on 400 taxa, so we have a pretty good idea that this is a true idea of the relationships and the stems and the folding things. Again, these areas of stem regions are going to be the most conserved areas of alignment across the matrix, and these areas of loop regions are going to be, you know, the areas of absolute nightmare alignment that you have to deal with in there. Some of these loop regions are actually part of the core region. They are highly conserved across all groups. What we do is we translate this into a Word document where we actually look at Watson-Crick base pairing, and we come up with ideas of stem homologies across the matrix, and then try and identify these areas of ambiguous alignment in between, which are a number of different things. If you want to check out the Texas A&M jRNA site, you can get an idea of how these are accomplished. We do work with these alignments in here because there is quite a bit of alignment or information within these data sets, although it is something that we have to deal with. It's more random. This is a summary of what we've done so far. We've got basically 69 of the potential 81 subfamilies across calcedoidea. I think that's pretty much of a record. I don't think we're going to go much. We have one more subfamily to add, which will be there before January, and that'll be about as far as we can go. It's just a number of rare groups that we will never probably be able to add in here. We've got 11% of the genera, which is, you know, pitiful, but, you know, with an explosive diversity like that, I think we're actually doing very good. And we're up to 535 taxa in this matrix, so that's just basically a quick summary in here. And we have 31 outgroups that we're working with to try and represent the overall diversity outside of calcedoidea. Now, as you can see from this clear tree, we've been actually, this size of a data set, one of the biggest things we're working is we're using the Cypress web portal for submitting all our runs. We can actually run POP, we can actually run maximum likelihood. We've been using their Garli analysis. It takes about 8 hours to run this analysis for a single run. And they just added RaxML, and they've just added bootstrapping capability, so we hope we can come back with a little bit more data as we start analyzing this in the winter. So you might be able to have a chance of reading this. That little red arrow is that calcedoidea, thank God, are monophyletic in all of our analyses. Mimerids are consistently coming out as a sister group of the rest of the calcedoids, which is just what we expect, and John Huber says to me that he likes some of the relationships we're actually showing up in these trees. The mimeric relationship is also supported by a secondary structural feature. If you can see, everything of the outgroups above and the mimerids plus other calcedoids share a general region of basically an extension of this one particular region. And we find this in a few places within the DNA of the particular group. And that's consistent all the way down, if you want to go all the way down through the 500 or so calcedoid taxa, and there is no change in that insert region. It may be variable, but it's there, and it's a structural character now that we can actually use to define the morphology of the group. We can also find characteristics that define mimerids outside of calcedoidea. So this is basically calcedoidea defined strictly by this quick little drop down to a U, and that U goes all the way down through all of the calcedoidea. So we've got this, again, structural features which can tell us the positive and negative aspects of a relationship. Unfortunately, it doesn't show up much within calcedoidea itself. Eggionids are a neat group just because they're fig parasites. They've been estimated to be about 90 million years old to correlate with the fig evolution. What's peculiar about those is they have tremendous inserts which are dropped in there, where you can actually see this all the way through their genome, where you can define and see this all the way through their genome, where you can define an agionid within an instant. You know when you've got a proper agionid sequence in there, and if it doesn't have that, then somebody made an error. Inserteds are really neat because, well, they're little cool things, and we've got this new little genus up here, Sevdargia, if you can pronounce that from Japan. It actually does look like it should belong there as the most basal inserted. John Noyes, British Museum, says he likes the relationships we get in our tree. And I just want to point down that get down here, in particular, the family name Insertidae actually correlates with a large number of insertions that we get into the genome that are coming down there. And the interesting thing about all that was, I talked about this before and we haven't pursued it much further, is those insertions actually correlate with retrotransposase proteins. When you do a blast on just the insertion, we're coming up with these, and we got an idea talking to some molecular biologists that it could be that these are just the signature elements of a retrotransposon jumping into the genome, jumping out, and then leaving back these trace elements. And Jim Woolley's done some great stuff about analyzing the inserted data set that he has, taking out those insert regions, and then reanalyzing the data and actually coming up with a very clear set of relationships that were not apparent there when those inserts were included. So there could be a more potential reason for why you exclude these regions rather than just their variable. Ulophids, we've got an absolute perfect ulophid relationship here, which is we've got the four subfamilies within ulophids coming out almost perfectly. I mean, this is just a group that's defined by reductions, but molecularly they're interesting. The neat thing about them is they have almost no molecular divergence. They're extremely conserved across this group. So we've got 4,000 species, they're globally distributed, and they have, compared to the other families of Chalcedoidea, almost no molecular divergence for one particular gene, and that's correlated across all their gene regions. So extreme molecular conservatism, and we're still toying with the idea, is this a sign of a recent divergence within a group, or is it a sign of an old divergence where they're actually showing high molecular conservatism? Let's see if I get movements here. Do something. Okay. Aphelinids, they're not coming out as monophyletic, but there was no expectation that they ever would come out as monophyletic, but we are getting the subfamily relationships coming out for what we believe are true within these things. Eurytomids come across as we're actually getting monophyletic rhyolines and eurytomines, and we're leaving off one group which is considered to be a eurytomine, but it's kind of weird, and we have another group of heme brines which are kind of odd. Pterimids are coming out at the subfamily level, but they don't group together at the family level. Again, these are things which are sort of an indication that maybe our backbone's just not strong enough, or maybe we don't really understand the relationships through convergence here. Pteromelines is a really interesting group in that this is, again, showing extreme molecular conservatism. This group is killing all sorts of Lepidoptera, but it also kills fig wasp parasites, and all the fig wasp parasite families, which are subfamilies, which are listed... Okay, it's not going to go back. All those parasite...
That one.
All these parasite subfamilies... don't touch that. That doesn't matter. What happens is those subfamilies all there are coming out embedded in pteromelines, so all the fig wasp parasites are showing extreme morphological divergence, which is not correlated with the molecular divergence. So we're going all over the place here. But stop. Don't touch anything. So they're all embedded within there. Almost no molecular divergence, and we're actually getting things where a single base pair defines things which could not ever be placed. They're basically things which are being put together as a different genus. And that's also incorporating another bunch of genes which are being looked at by Roger Birch, my student. Trichogrammatids are coming out as monophyletic, and we have this one clade. This is the one consistent clade where we have higher group level relationships. We're consistent in all of our analyses so far. Again, no bootstrap analysis results at this point, but hopefully we'll get something. The subfamily Pteromelidae, there's 35 subfamilies, and they come out just like they are. They're just a giant polyphyletic mess across the entire tree. If it's a weird Pteromelid, it comes out in a weird place, and hopefully John Wenzel's subtree analysis might help us out with that. All right, now this is why you're all here, to find out that Lepidoptera are monophyletic. We have two taxon statement in there, and also, thankfully, Hymenoptera. So this is the results of the Tree of Life study looking at all Hymenoptera, where we've got a larger gene set here of 7,250 bases. We have about 100 taxa of Hymenoptera in here. We're getting exactly what we should get of having a monophyletic Hymenoptera with Symphyta as basal. If you heard Barb Sharanowski's talk, we're getting basically a large expanded Evaneomorpha coming across here. We get Ichneumonoids as sister group to Proctotrupomorpha. There's no bootstrap support for that. However, there is bootstrap support for Proctotrupomorpha. And down there, lovely enough, is Chalcedoidea are monophyletic. And the relationships basically mirror what we're getting out of the large analysis of 535 taxa with Mimerids as basal. Okay, so current results in summary. We've got basically a big analysis. We still have Mimerids as basal. Rotolitids is basal to the remainder. We have a number of families which are coming out as monophyletic in the analysis, although their relationships still between each other are pretty unstable. And we still have some groups which are not coming out as monophyletic, but basically no matter what we've done, adding more taxa, they're not coming together, so we really have to reevaluate those. I have a lot of people to thank and a lot of people that are collecting and sending us material, and it's been just a wonderful experience. And that's it. Thank you very much.